Welcome to El Petróleo Es Nuestro, Episode 1, The Oil Finders. I'm Brandon Seal. The best place to begin a history of oil in Mexico, or any history of Mexico for the last 100 years for that matter, is with Porfirio Díaz, who I'll call Porfirio going forward to make it easy on American ears. The mestizo son of an innkeeper and the sixth of seven children, Porfirio entered the military at the age of 16 with the outbreak of the Mexican-American War. In the political turmoil following the Mexican defeat, Porfirio aligned himself with the liberal, in the 19th century sense of the word, faction, though it should be noted that ideologies were often fluid amongst the parties vying for control of the Mexican government in the 19th century. Porfirio first rose to national fame after his actions in the Battle of Puebla in 1862 against the French, a battle today commemorated by Cinco de Mayo. According to some accounts, he, and not the commanding general Ignacio Zaragoza, was the real hero of the battle. He continued to serve with distinction in Benito Juarez's struggle against the French Emperor Maximilian, and eventually helped drive the imperialist forces from the country. But only 3 years after this victory, Porfirio would raise the banner of revolt against Juarez himself, and eventually defeat him in 1872. After stepping out of the national spotlight briefly, Porfirio returned under arms in 1876, and finally ascended to the presidency in May of 1877. Porfirio Díaz would not relinquish his authority over the Mexican state for another 34 years. The age itself would take on his name, the Porfiriato, and to this day, the man remains a controversial symbol of prosperity to some and oppression to others. On the one hand, perhaps no period in Mexican history has ever seen such economic stability and growth as Mexico would experience during the Porfiriato. By some accounts, the standard of living in Mexico in 1911, at the end of his reign, would not be matched again until the 1980s. Porfirio's economic prosperity, however, was marred by cronyism and oppressive anti-democratic measures. Porfirio, it was said, offered the people of Mexico pan o palo, bread or a beating. And you need only read a few chapters of John Kenneth Turner's Barbarous Mexico for a heart-wrenching account of the life of the lowest classes under Porfirio. The Mexican Revolution to come was a revolution against Porfirio. And yet the memory of the stability of the Porfiriato would only grow stronger through the trauma of the revolution. Porfirio's successors, first and foremost, would all endeavor to recreate this Porfirian stability, eventually settling on a single-party system with real decision-making power kept hidden behind closed doors where passions could be managed before they spilled into the streets, the so-called perfect dictatorship that the PRI party offered Mexico for most of the 20th century. But we're not there yet. Let's start in the halcyon days before the Mexican Revolution in 1884, when Porfirio signed a law transferring ownership of the subsurface to individual landowners. Americans are often surprised to learn that the rest of the world does not recognize private ownership of the subsurface. The rest of the world is often equally surprised to learn that America does. Porfirio was clearly imitating the American precedent, recognizing private ownership of minerals beneath privately held lands. Yet he was also equally clearly acting in defiance of hundreds if not thousands of years of Spanish tradition, which reserved those minerals to the sovereign. As such, the law was a windfall to landowners, but it created the first real incentives for oil and gas exploration. It was followed up by the 1901 Petroleum Law that exempted from taxes for 10 years the export of petroleum products, the import of oil extraction equipment, and all corporations engaged in the extraction of oil and gas. These reforms served their purpose, and foreign capital soon arrived on Mexican shores, intent on developing its oil resources. In 1898, Standard Oil's marketing firm in the U.S. Southwest, Waters Pierce, established themselves in Mexico. Waters Pierce focused primarily on the distribution of refined products to Mexico's cities and small industrial centers, and built several small, we're talking 100 barrel per day, refineries close to these major consumption points. Waters Pierce would quickly develop a near monopoly in Mexico, a situation that troubled Porfirio, and would eventually lead him to invite in British capitalists as a counterweight, including a certain Wheatman Pearson, the future founder of the famous El Aguila. Pearson would become probably the most important single foreigner in Mexico's pre-expropriation period. Pearson had arrived in Mexico in 1889 at the age of 33 to build railroads. It was Porfirio himself that encouraged him to try to develop the tar pits and oil seeps that he had seen during his railroad surveys and noted on his maps. In 1906, Pearson negotiated a 50-year concession covering nearly the entire Mexican state of Veracruz in exchange for a 7% national royalty and a 3% state royalty. This may sound like a sweetheart deal to modern ears accustomed to 25% royalties and 50% profit-sharing terms, but it's worth noting that the standard royalty in Texas at this time was only 1/8 or 12.5%, and Texas offered much better infrastructure for accessing the oil and much better markets for selling it in. Around the same time as Pearson was getting started, a Californian his same age would begin building El Aguila's greatest competition, La Huasteca. Edward Doheny was 44 in 1900 when he acquired his first major lease, a 400,000-acre hacienda west of Tampico and a few hundred miles south of the Texas border. It was Doheny who would first find commercial success in the Mexican oil fields when in 1901, at 525 feet, he brought on the El Ebano well at some 50 barrels per day of low-gravity crude, as thick as cold honey, in his words. The crude was too heavy to yield commercial quantities of the lighter cuts like kerosene that were in highest demand at the time, so Doheny set up his own asphalt company and began supplying railroads with bunker fuel. But marketing was never Doheny's passion. Fundamentally, he was an explorationist, a searcher, and at his best when he was finding oil, not when he was having to sell it. In fact, in 1902, before some of his biggest finds, he nearly had to sell out to Standard, who had taken the opportunity created by Spindletop's surging production to go shopping for depressed oil properties throughout North America. But Doheny pulled through, with a grit familiar to anyone who has studied the lives of the great oil finders. He plugged along, drilling out the El Ebano field, before eventually partnering with one Ezequiel Ordóñez, later to be recognized as the father of Mexican petroleum geology. Ordóñez was 10 years younger than Doheny, a scientist, a trained engineer and surveyor, and a former employee of the Mexican Finance Ministry, who had run him off after he published a report on the prospects for oil development in Mexico, which his superiors judged to be irresponsibly optimistic. His bosses, it should be said, were in good company at the time. Prior to Spindletop and the great Mexican gushers to come, the world's concept of the available supply of oil was so limited that one Standard Oil executive famously promised to drink all of the oil west of the Mississippi, proving that peak oil theorists have a long and distinguished history. In 1904, Doheny and Ordóñez drilled the Lopez No. 1 and brought on a 1,500-barrel-per-day well at 1,650 feet subsurface. To the non-initiated, it may be helpful to note that at an oil price of $40 per barrel, that's some $60,000 per day of cash flow on a well that today would cost maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars to drill. As you can see, quite a handsome return. After the Lopez well, and a few other small successes, but many geologic and mechanical failures as well, in 1906, Doheny capitalized the Huasteca Petroleum Company and took the incredibly bold and frankly premature step of building out a nearly 1 million barrel tank farm and a 70-mile, 8-inch pipeline with 10 pump stations to get his crude to the coast. All this at a time when he was only producing a few thousand barrels per day. The move, however, would prove to be prescient, if not outright short-sighted, as he would eventually have to loop this 8-inch pipeline with another one to handle all of his production. Because in 1910, Huasteca drilled the Juan Casiano No. 7. The Juan Casiano would come on at 60,000 barrels per day and produce almost 85 million barrels of oil in 10 years. That would be $3.5 billion of revenue at today's oil prices. And this wasn't the only well in the field. Huasteca would drill several more Juan Casiano wells that came on at tens of thousands of barrels per day each. But even better luck befell Huasteca in 1911 from an unexpected source when the U.S. Supreme Court dissolves Standard Oil. As a result of this ruling, the baby Standard Oils suddenly needed feedstock from non-Standard Oil companies to feed their refineries. And so Jersey Standard, the future Exxon, cut a deal with Doheny to take all of his Mexican production. Doheny's marketing problems were solved. Pearson, in the meantime, had discovered his own gusher 2 years before Doheny's Juan Casiano. In 1908, at 1,832 feet, Wheatman Pearson brought on the Dos Bocas well and truly ushered in the gusher age to Mexico. Most of these early Mexican gushers were, in fact, terrifying examples of how exploration techniques had outstripped well-controlled technology. The Dos Bocas well was a fine example of this. The Dos Bocas blew out a column of oil 850 feet high, gusting to 1,400 feet. It formed a crater 300 feet across and burned for 2 months as it spewed 100,000 barrels per day of oil into the air. Pearson followed up the Dos Bocas well with the Potrero del Llano No. 3, which also blew out and burned for 3 years before it was brought under control. Each of these wells likely matched or bested Spindletop's 100,000 barrel per day initial rate, but because neither was brought under control, they were not commercial successes. Commercial success would elude Pearson until his engagement of the 24-year-old C. Everett de Goyler in 1909. De Goyler goes down in the industry as the father of geophysics, in contrast to the early oil prospectors who could only be called geologists in the sense that they made high-level and often baseless extrapolations of the subsurface based on surface topographical features. De Goyler was one of the first to focus on the physical properties of the rocks themselves. As such, he was one of the first to appreciate the difference between the fractured and vugular, that is, Swiss cheesy, limestones producing in Mexico versus the salt domes, anticlines, and oil sands that were driving production along the Texas Gulf Coast. De Goyler's name lives on today in the firm De Goyler & McNaughton, one of the premier reservoir engineering firms in the world. But De Goyler's name also lives on because of the Potrero del Llano No. 4 well. Like the Dos Bocas and Potrero del Llano No. 3 wells, the Potrero del Llano No. 4 blew out, in this case with an oil plume 250 feet high. This time, however, labor was on hand to build enormous earthen dams to capture the oil, and though it took more than 9 months to bring the well under control, the oil was largely contained. The Potrero del Llano No. 4 made Pearson the largest oil producer in the country, and a serious threat to Waters Pierce. Unlike Doheny's La Huasteca, which focused primarily on the export of their lighter crudes to foreign markets, Pearson wanted to compete for the domestic Mexican market. After a failed flirtation with a combination with Waters Pierce, Pearson formed La Compañía Mexicana de Petróleo El Águila with British and Mexican capital. He built a refinery in Minatitlan with almost 2,000 barrels a day of capacity. Minatitlan to this day is home to one of Mexico's 6 refineries. Pearson's El Águila soon controlled over half of the domestic retail market, outcompeting Waters Pierce thanks to his access to cheap local crude. Indeed, it was Waters Pierce's ties to Standard Oil that would be their downfall, first by preventing them from integrating vertically in Mexico the way that El Águila would, second by leaving them without any supply once the Standard Oil Trust was busted, and third by making them a political target. Porfirio had always favored a British counterweight to Standard Oil's presence in Mexico, and so looked for ways to help El Águila in their battle to unseat Waters Pierce by a selective taxation and critical coverage in the Mexican press. Undoubtedly, Pearson's strategy of placing administration officials and prominent Mexican industrialists in high places within El Águila, including Porfirio's son and finance minister, helped, and indeed stands in stark contrast to Doheny, who seemed to take an active pride in his antagonisms with Mexican government officials, and claimed he never once paid a bribe in Mexico. Truthfully, he probably didn't need to. His markets were almost all external, his exports were tax-free, and his leases came directly from landowners he negotiated with, not from states or Mexican federal entities. He didn't need government favor in the same way that a company engaged in a highly visible retail business of a staple consumer good, like El Águila, did. And Doheny especially didn't need any favors after 1916. When he and Ordóñez drilled the Cerro Azul No. 4. At 1,792 feet, the well came to see them, and the famed Mexican Faja de Oro, Golden Lane, was in play. Initially, the Cerro Azul tested at 152,000 barrels per day, making it likely the largest gusher in the history of the world at that time. But the flow rate kept increasing. 4 days later, it was producing 260,858 barrels per day. By one account, it would peak at a spot rate of 385,240 barrels per day, almost 4 times Spindletop's earth-shattering rate. In its first 20 years, the Cerro Azul No. 4 would produce 89 million barrels of oil. Today, 100 years later, it still produces some 17 barrels per day. The Cerro Azul is the stuff of legends. It's a return on investment that is seen maybe once in a generation. It's the kind of return on investment that today could only be matched by a tech company like Google or Facebook. And in their own day, these oil finders captured the imagination of their peers in much the same way that tech billionaires do today. These great oil finders became celebrities, then institutions, and then slowly villains as their novelty wore off and they fell badly out of sync with the politics of their times. And so Doheny goes down as a byword for American exploitation of Mexican wealth. Pearson gets off a little easier personally, probably because there's a whole ocean to keep the Brits from coming back to Mexico, and only that damn muddy little river to keep the gringos out. Yet it was Pearson's El Aguila that would be the great villain of the oil expropriation battle to come. By 1918, El Aguila had produced 16.9 billion barrels of oil since they had brought in the gusher age in Mexico in 1908. La Huasteca had produced 20.2 billion barrels of oil over the same period. That's about 5,000 barrels per day each, on average, over a 10-year period, which meant that El Aguila and La Huasteca had each produced approximately one-third of the oil produced in Mexico to date. Indeed, the Juan Casiano and Potrero del Llano wells alone produced almost one-third of the oil that Mexico would produce between 1910 and 1920, when daily national production grew from only 10,000 barrels per day to 555,000 barrels per day from some 700 wells. By 1921, Pearson, Ordóñez, Doheny, de Goyler, and many others had made Mexico the second largest oil producer in the world, behind only the United States, and producing almost three times as much as the third largest producer, Russia. And even though Pearson, Doheny, and these others figure as the bad guys in most Mexican histories of oil, all Mexican histories of oil begin with them. And it's because I don't think you can help but admire the amount of money that these men were able to raise based on a vision, and that they were willing to deploy based on a hope. And this is where I think the analogy to the tech billionaires breaks down. What makes technology so fascinating is how such enormous fortunes can be made on such small investments. Pearson and Doheny, on the other hand, made enormous capital investments in infrastructure before they ever brought on their great gushers. Doheny with his tank farms and pipelines, Pearson with his refineries and distribution networks. And both of them made these enormous investments without any guarantees that their products would even have markets to sell into. So what made these men do this? I mean, obviously they got something financially out of it. Pearson, Doheny, and their associates all became spectacularly wealthy, but greed isn't what makes men successful, it only makes them desperate to succeed. What made them do it fundamentally is that they were risk takers, visionaries, in the finest capitalist sense of the word. Of course, in a different life or under a different set of circumstances, they might have just been lunatics. But they had found their time and place there in the early Mexican oil field. And there's a refrain that I always think of when I meet people like Doheny and Pearson, and yes, they are out there in the oil business and elsewhere. A refrain whose source I can't recall, but that goes something like this: I'll never give up. I'll never stop drilling. There's oil down there. I've got a good feeling. Ha, I love it. Sometimes a trite couplet is the only way to properly capture romantic insanity. But now for the real question that should be at the front of everyone's mind. Where were the Mexican oil men? Why were foreigners leading the way here? One answer is that foreigners simply knew the business better. Brits and Americans had started the worldwide search for oil and so had a cultural leg up. The second answer, and also a benefit of the Anglo-American cultural legacy, was access to capital. As mentioned above, and as will be mentioned again, Mexico has always struggled to access capital, to accumulate capital. Indeed, particularly following the instability of the Mexican Revolution, even their own upper classes have typically preferred to park dollars in Anglo-American countries rather than look for ways to deploy them in their own. But there's a much simpler third answer to why we don't see many Mexican oil men during this period. During all of these heady years of exploration and gushers, Mexico was convulsed with the violence of the Mexican Revolution. Over 1 million Mexicans would die during this decade, likely the most traumatic and bloody episode in the history of the Americas since 1492. No Mexican was untouched, no part of Mexican society untroubled. In the next episode, we'll follow the revolution as it racks Mexico and gives birth to the oil workers' movement. We'll see the supermajors arrive and plant their flags in Mexican soil, bringing with them the geopolitics of oil. Soon, the lines of the great expropriation battle will be drawn and left to play out in a way that no one could have guessed in 1921. Thank you for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and leave us a rating and some feedback. You can download this episode at www.brandonseal.com. Also, I thought I would provide some suggested further readings for each of these episodes. For this first episode, check out Jonathan C. Brown's Oil and Revolution in Mexico, available online at the California Digital Library. It's a thoroughly researched yet highly readable academic account of the 20 years that I've covered in about 20 minutes here. Hasta la próxima.